Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Thank you for joining us for a Tuesday edition of our podcast. You know, prosecutors have been in the news a lot lately for good, I guess, sometimes, and more oftentimes, not so good reasons. Most prosecutors, I have to tell you, are not like Alvin Bragg. They're not like Bonnie Willis. Most prosecutors take their job seriously, and they're responsible stewards of the tremendous power that they've been given. So what I wanted to do today was talk to a prosecutor to make sure a couple of things, that we know exactly what they do and don't do. And the reason I chose the prosecutor I chose today is because I have known him for a very long time. He's been a friend for a very long time, but he was also someone I relied upon greatly when I was a prosecutor. He was not a politician who decided he wanted to be the district attorney, or what we call solicitor, in South Carolina. He literally rose through the ranks. So he knows his way around a courtroom. He knows how to run an office. Most of us, I think, have a sense of what cops do. We think we know what judges do. It is that interim that I am most familiar with, but I think the public sometimes is not. So we're going to try to fix that today. With that, welcome, solicitor, also known throughout the rest of the world as district attorney, Kevin Brackett. How are you?
I'm doing great, Trey. I hope you are.
I am. I'm always a little surprised at what folks know and don't know about the role of prosecutors. I mean, I think we understand cops and judges, but what if you've done it for a long time? It's all you've done for a long time, but do you still run into misconceptions about what exactly your job is?
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, people think that my job is to try to convict everybody that comes my way via a warrant or an indictment. They think that, you know, my obligation is to just, you know, convict everybody who's charged, and it's not. My obligation is to make sure that justice is done in each and every case that comes through the criminal justice system. Sometimes justice can be the death penalty. I mean, in a really, really bad case, the death penalty is appropriate and warranted, and that's what we strive for. Other times it could be some kid who made a stupid mistake and did something dumb and doesn't have any real prior criminal history and could have a bright future in front of them. And our job is to try to correct their course and get them back on track so that they can become a productive citizen, not burn the scarlet letter on their forehead so that they carry a criminal record around. So it could be anything from a diversion program that gives them a second chance to, you know, trying to put them in prison. But our first obligation as a prosecutor is always to make sure that in any case, the evidence that we have, that the police collected in their investigation, justifies the charge, that it's the appropriate charge, and that the charge is supported by that evidence, that we can prove it. Because as horrible as it is for a guilty person to go free, it's far worse for an innocent person to be prosecuted or, God forbid, put in prison for something they didn't do. So we have, those are both equally important, and I make sure every member of my staff hears from my mouth within a short time arriving in my office that you should take every bit as much pride in dismissing a bad case as you do in prosecuting a good one.
All right. Speaking of your office, you mentioned the word warrant. How many warrants? So just so our listeners know, police officers, almost exclusively in the state system — this is not true in the federal system, but in the state system, which is where 95% of all this stuff happens — police officers decide who to charge, what to charge them with, when to go to a magistrate seeking a warrant. The district attorney is not involved in that oftentimes. So how many warrants come into your office each year?
We get in, I have two counties, so York and Union. York is by far my larger county. And we get somewhere between 7,000, 7,500 warrants a year in York and about another 1,200 in Union. So it can be upwards of 9,000, just shy of 9,000 warrants. And of course, a warrant is just an individual charge. You can have multiple charges, multiple warrants arise from one incident. If you go into a store, you rob the clerk, you assault the clerk, you steal a car, carjack somebody on your way out to make your getaway, all of those could result in a separate warrant for each individual criminal act. So each warrant is not a case. You know, one case can have 20 warrants.
All right. But yet, unless they've changed things, you are judged based on how you resolve warrants.
That's right.
And my question for district attorneys like you is always, okay, I hear 8,000 plus warrants come into your office every year. In a perfect world, if everyone showed up on time, if the judges were sober, if the jurors were not late, if everything worked flawlessly, how many cases can you try in a year?
Oh, in front of a jury?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Well, if you said on average that you a single trial took 2 days, you know, because a murder might take 5 days, it might take 2 weeks. You can do a DUI in an afternoon under the right circumstances. So if you just said an average of 2 days, And then, you know, we have about 2 to 2.5 warrants per case. So 240 days of court that are given to us. Of course, a number of those days are consumed by probation revocation. So just at 240, at 2 days, I could move 120 cases or about, you know, 250 warrants, 300 warrants a year by trial. And of course, that would leave me with another 7,500 warrants that would then carry forward to the next year to be added to the 8,000 that came in that year. So, yeah, it would be a losing proposition, Trey.
Which is exactly my point.
Yeah.
And because the circuit that I used to work in is a little bit bigger than yours, we could try 150 cases a year if everything was flawless out of the 12,000 warrants that came in.
Yep.
So when people say, you know, why would you dismiss a case? Why would you? It's funny, Kevin, the feds call it plea negotiations and nobody has a problem with it. The state calls it plea bargaining for some reason and everybody's opposed to it, even though it's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
You have to resolve these warrants or then you have a backlog. And people judge you based on your backlog.
And the people whose cases are backlogged get no justice at all. So you have to leverage the court time that you have to extract the maximum amount of justice you can out of the viable cases that you have. I think the analogy that I like is a prosecutor is like a man who's confronted by a mob. And I've got a pistol with 6 bullets in it. And the mob could rush me and overwhelm me. But 6 of them are going to catch a bullet. So that's what keeps the mob at bay. I can try some, and I use that to, pick and choose carefully. But I also know that I have to bargain some of these cases out. Otherwise, so many victims will never see their day in court.
Which, to me, again, I got to work in both systems. I never heard any complaints about plea negotiations in the federal system because they use the word negotiation. For some reason, in the state system, the word bargain is used a lot, which to me denotes that you are getting something for less than what it's worth. I don't know the worth of a case that will never see the inside of a courtroom. I mean, what is that case worth? If you can't try it for 5 years, what is it worth? And I mean, give people a sense. I mean, time is like never your friend in the criminal justice system. What could happen over the course of 5 years if you were trying to prosecute a case?
Yeah, no question about it. Witnesses disappear, memories fade, evidence can get lost. So many things can happen. Cases are definitely not like wine. They do not improve with age. And justice delayed is often justice denied for the people who are involved in a case, the victims, the defendants, everybody involved. So there's no question about it. Yeah, we have to plea bargain. And sometimes you plea bargain because the quality of your case is not everything you want it to be. You know he did something, but you may lose the critical piece of evidence on a legal motion because it may not have been obtained according to the Fourth Amendment, and it may be thrown out, in which case your case falls apart. So you gamble and the defense gambles that you're going to win. We gamble that they're going to win, and we come to some sort of resolution we can both live with. I mean, that's frequently the situation in plea bargains. You get what you can out of a case.
You used the word quality, which caught my ear. You and I both have a lot of friends in law enforcement. It's an incredibly difficult job, a lot of courage, overworked, underpaid. The same can be said for many of the people in your office, too, by the way, that they're overworked and underpaid. But let's lay all of that aside. They're different functions. So your sheriff's deputies can go seek and obtain an arrest warrant based on probable cause.
Right.
That ain't going to get you very far. You have to get a conviction based on beyond a reasonable doubt. So role of a prosecutor in getting from the arrest to the conviction stage, how do you do that?
Well, you know, I tell people all the time, it takes an ounce of evidence to get a warrant. It takes a pound of evidence to get a conviction. And sometimes we get cases in from law enforcement that have 50 pounds of evidence. We are swimming in evidence. We've got so much of it, and guilt is really a foregone conclusion. Other times it might be 12 or 14 ounces, or it might be 19 or 20, just over, just under, and you're not really sure if it's going to measure up in the jury's eyes. So, you know, our job, once we get the case in, and that's no fault of law enforcement. Sometimes they go out and they gather every bit of evidence there is to be gathered, and there's just nothing else to get. But we work with law enforcement once the case comes in, review it, because we look at it with an eye towards conviction. And sometimes we see things that might make a case stronger. So we reach out to our partners in blue and see if we can't shore the case up, gather some additional evidence. You know, sometimes it involves making a deal with a co-defendant and getting that co-defendant to cooperate and give testimony against their partner in crime in court. And, you know, so there's all sorts of things we can do at our end that law enforcement couldn't do at theirs, because law enforcement's not allowed to make deals with people. That's a prosecutorial decision. So, you know, our job is, once we review it and decide that this is the right person, they did it, and we think they're responsible, then our job is to go through the evidence and marshal it and shore it up and strengthen the case as best we can and before we take it into court.
You're listening to my conversation with Solicitor Kevin Brackett.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
So to summarize for our listeners, you can have mountains and mountains of evidence in most state criminal justice systems, and you still can't take everything to trial because the numbers don't work. The number of warrants vastly outnumbers the number of trial slots you would have. Is that fair to say?
That is exactly correct.
All right. And if I'm facing 20 years in prison, what are the chances of me pleading to 20 years in prison? If that's the maximum I can get, and that's what I'm going to get if I plead guilty, what incentive would I have to not go to trial? I mean, you have to incent people, right?
Absolutely. There has to be some benefit to the defendant in order to induce them to come into court. To get them to plead guilty. So, you know, that is absolutely correct. If you just come right out and say, how about your guy pleads for the maximum, then well, what point is there in that? He might as well roll the dice in front of a jury. Something may happen.
But there are also advantages and benefits, I think, for victims.
Yes.
It's very hard to lose a guilty plea. I don't think I ever lost one, Kevin.
No, come to think of it, I don't think I have either.
And it keeps the victim from having to testify, right?
Yes, which is a major consideration, especially when you have victims of tender years who were traumatized. You don't want to put a child on the stand, if you can help it. Absolutely. And there's appellate benefits as well, because, as you know, I've got cases I tried in the mid-90s that are still being litigated. So, 25, 30 years later, we're still dealing with post-conviction relief or habeas corpus proceedings, appeals on those. It just goes on and on and on. So with a guilty plea, you're pretty much getting certainty that this case is resolved with finality. So there's a lot of value in a guilty plea for the victims.
All right. One more hypothetical fact pattern. I'm a police officer. You're the district attorney. I make an arrest. I do the best I can, and I come and sit down with you. And I guess the options are, there are some other evidentiary avenues we can pursue to see if we can get this thing up to beyond a reasonable doubt. You did the very best you could do. It's not getting any better. I can't win the case. I either dismiss it or I try to work it out. What am I missing? Because that to me seems like the life of a prosecutor. You either have enough evidence to go to trial, but maybe not enough time. Or yep. There's an evidentiary shortcoming that you either have to deal with through a dismissal or through plea negotiations.
That's exactly right. And it's, sometimes it's what they call a Hobson's choice. You have to choose between two bad options. But if you know that you have the right person, then you have to try to squeeze the justice you can out of the case as best you can. And that involves some in major cases where, the violent crimes where people have been brutally victimized. It can be very hard to sit down with families and tell them, here's our situation. I'm not optimistic about our chances at trial. He's willing to plead right now for probation. You see a lot of this in sexual assault cases, as you know, Trey. It's really hard. There's usually no witnesses, and if they're delayed reporting and they don't have DNA or anything like that, it can be really challenging to win those cases. So you try to get the justice that the evidence allows for. It's not always satisfactory because you feel in your heart that this person did this, but it's either that or nothing. And oftentimes it comes down to a choice that stark. And as you pointed out at the beginning of this conversation, we don't have the luxury of choosing like in federal court. I know when you're a federal prosecutor, the FBI comes in with a neat binder tabbed and everything's laid out in front of you and you've got the case and you can decide whether you want to take it or not. They don't even arrest the person until it's approved by the AUSA. With us, it's a conveyor belt that is bringing a steady stream of cases of varying quality to us, and we have to go through them all.
The analogy I like to give people, solicitor, and I think I can give this analogy because I've worked in both systems and I've seen them, their strengths and their weaknesses. When you're a federal prosecutor, you are an expert on one particular gene. When you are a state prosecutor, you are an emergency room physician. You see whatever comes in on a Saturday night when people have been out hooting and hollering and drinking and knifing and all that other stuff. You are overwhelmed. Federal prosecutors can say, I'm going to specialize in this particular gene or this particular type of bone surgery. I mean, you with 8,000 warrants don't have that luxury.
Oh, yeah. No, it is definitely emergency room medicine that we're practicing. Or I've used the example, we're like the Army or the Marines. We're on the ground grinding it out day after day. And the feds are kind of like the Air Force. They are they can come in and bring a tremendous amount of ordnance to bear on one target. So we're down there fighting hand to hand. And they're sort of like able to say, OK, today we're going to destroy that. And they can go in and handle it. So, the feds definitely have their place, and we value our relationships with the federal, with our federal partners. But it is a completely different set of goals and tools that we have at our disposal.
They gave an award Beatty Ashmore's a dear friend of mine. I'm sure he's a friend of yours too. They gave an award to Beatty and me when we were federal prosecutors, because I think we handled like 120 cases that year. That's like a bad week for a state prosecutor.
I mean, No, we routinely move 100 to 150 in a week of guilty pleas and trials in a court week. That's just, absolutely. It's a completely different dynamic.
Before I move on to an issue that is percolating in South Carolina but has national implications, I want to ask you one more question about your job, which is the exercise of your discretion. Your predecessor, someone that both of us like and respect very much, a man by the name of Tommy Pope, made national news because he sought the death penalty against a woman named Susan Smith, who drowned, murdered, killed her two sons.
And is up for parole this year, Trey. I don't know whether you knew that or not, but.
Yeah, because Brian Sterling is a very good friend of mine, as I'm sure he is yours too. He runs the Department of Corrections. And I said, Brian, what does it take for someone to weigh in on a parole hearing as a private citizen? Because I have very deeply held convictions when it comes to whether or not she should ever be paroled. But Tommy had to exercise his discretion. And I remember him because it was criticism. He was seeking the death penalty of a mother who had no criminal history, despite the fact that what she did was about as heinous a fact pattern as you can conjure. And Tommy said, how in the world can I seek the death penalty for a motorist who shoots a highway patrolman during a car stop? And I don't seek it for someone who premeditates the murder of her two sons. You have a job that requires you to use a lot of discretion, both from pretrial intervention, saving someone a conviction or that scarlet letter on their forehead, all the way to who to decide to put to death.
Right.
So how do you exercise that discretion?
Well, a lot of it just comes down to, your values and your assessment of this particular person in the universe of criminal behavior. When I have a new attorney come in the office, we sit down and I say, listen, in a very short time, a file is going to land on your desk. And that file will be it'll be a criminal case, and it will be the worst case you ever saw, because it's your first case and it's your only case. It will also be the least serious case you ever saw. But the second case is going to fit onto the spectrum of criminal behavior, and it will either be more serious or less serious than the first one. Well, after 2,000 or 3,000 of them, you start to get a sense of what is truly reprehensible. You know, in other words, who is a bad person and who's a good person who just had a bad day? So you've got to have this experience, and you've got to have this sense that develops over time. And really, you just answer to your conscience. You can't make decisions about whether to prosecute somebody for political reasons, for example. You can't do it because you have some animosity towards them personally or their family, and you want to seek retribution for something you perceive they did to you at an earlier time. Every decision you make has to be done for the right reasons. You can't just use the power that the people give you to punish your enemies or reward your friends. You have to do the right thing for the right reasons to the right people. And you know, that's what it comes down to. And we have varying degrees of success in this country when it comes to prosecutors. Many, many of them get it, and they do just that. From time to time, as you said early on in our conversation, you get a politician in there who is not just content with the office they're holding, but looking down the road to the next one and trying to figure out how they can use a certain case to perhaps enhance their prospects, for attorney general or governor or something else. So, you've got to have good people making these decisions, because we do have a tremendous amount of power over people's lives and their liberty, and it needs to be exercised carefully, cautiously, and thoughtfully. And you know, like I said to everybody when I talk about this issue, you know, ultimately, I answer to my conscience. And, you know, it's important to me to get a good night's sleep. And I can't sit there, you know, if I knew that I'd done something to somebody just for pure political reasons, I would have a very hard time doing that. So, I think prosecutorial discretion is is overlooked. It's perhaps getting a little more attention now, though.
Particularly when it's abused. And my point is what you just made. The overwhelming majority of prosecutors do the right thing for the right reasons. They just, you don't make the news when you don't drop the baby. Speaking of a good night's sleep, judges, and I'm really thinking of federal judges who that's a pretty good gig. South Carolina elects judges a little bit differently. You're not appointed for life. You're not nominated by a president with a little input from a U.S. senator. In South Carolina, it is possible that you would go up against a lawyer legislator who in theory could be on the screening committee deciding whether or not a man or a woman is eligible to run for a judgeship, whether he or she is picked as one of the three finalists. And then ultimately, that lawyer legislator on the other side of the courtroom from you votes on judges. And I think there's a lot of scrutiny lately that maybe there's a better way.
It has been a problem, and it's something that is being talked about here, should be talked about. People don't really think about these kinds of issues. You just think these judges mysteriously appear on the bench in a robe and start dispensing justice, but you don't think, how did they get there, and who are they beholden to? South Carolina is one of only two states in the country in which the legislature chooses the judges. And of course, in the legislature, you've got lawyers who serve in the Senate and the House, who also practice law in front of the judges they pick. So, you know, everybody says, well, why are you down on the judges? I'm not down on the judges because I'm advocating vigorously for a change in how we select them. But I'm not down on the judges. I'm not criticizing them. I'm criticizing the system that allows for a lawyer legislator. And you said it's possible for one to come into court opposite me. Not only is it possible, it has happened repeatedly. It is a system which creates the very real possibility that the people who select judges are able to exploit this power and influence the decisions that judges are making by virtue of the fact that those judges know I have to go back in front of this man to keep my job. Everybody who ever took civics knows we have three branches of government. We've got the legislature, the judiciary, and the executive branch. And they're supposed to be co-equal, and they're supposed to check and balance each other. But in South Carolina, we have one branch of government that hires, pays, and can fire the other branch. And that's not a co-equal branch of government. That is an employee. That is somebody who is subservient to the other branch. And so it is creating problems. Not every legislator lawyer. You mentioned Tommy Pope. I have never heard tell, and I can't imagine that he ever would exploit the power that he has as a House member. But there are other House members and people in the Senate who do. And it's really got to stop. We have got to divide the responsibility like the feds do, divide the responsibility equally between the governor and the legislature. And then ultimately, I believe the best system is one that allows the people to decide whether or not somebody remains a judge after they've been put on the bench in a retention election, not a contested election where they have to go out and raise money or file as a Republican or a Democrat. Simply an up or down vote. Is this person doing a good job? So then you'd have the governor selecting, the legislature approving the decision after they've vetted them, and then ultimately the people deciding every 6 or 8 years, this person's doing a good job, they get to stay on the bench, or they're not doing a good job. It goes back to the governor to select a new judge. But what we have right now is we have a system that creates the real opportunity to influence the decisions that judges are making. And it's really abhorrent.
Well, the method that you described is vastly different from the method we have, because I'm imagining right now, not only could you be appearing on behalf of a victim, on behalf of the state of South Carolina, against a lawyer legislator who votes on the very judge who is making a ruling in your case, some of those lawyer legislators are actually on the screening committee. They decide whether or not a judge is deemed eligible to even run. And we've had some pretty quirky decisions. We've had some people who weren't all that qualified make it out of screening, and we've had some people who never made it out of screening, and we wonder why on both counts. But the reality, Kevin, you're a student of human nature. You have to be a prosecutor. History's not replete with instances of people giving up power.
No, so, no bird ever volunteered to have his wings clipped. I don't recall any species that ever did. And I don't think that the legislature is going to give this power up unless they are confronted by an angry public that demands it.
And sometimes the public can maybe not even be angry, just be smarter about it, that there is a better way, that it makes. I'll give you another example. You tell me if I'm wrong. Maybe it's changed since I left. But when I was there, state senators picked magistrate judges. Is it still that way?
Yes. And that's, yeah, I didn't know how deeply you wanted to dive. But yes, they actually are the only people as the. Under the law, the governor is theoretically the person responsible for selecting them. But the reality is that it is the state senator for that jurisdiction that picks the judge.
All right. And just so folks know, magistrate judges in South Carolina, unless everything's changed since I left, they preside over DUI cases, some of them. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Domestic violence cases, some of them.
That is possible. Yes, sir.
They set bond?
They set all the bonds except in cases where the penalty is life. That's right.
All right. So the person in theory can be presiding over a DUI case with the defense attorney being a state senator who actually is responsible for determining whether or not that magistrate is reappointed to that job.
That's exactly right. Every 4 years that magistrate comes up for reappointment. And that senator can decide whether to reappoint them or not. So literally the job of that magistrate is in the hands of the lawyer appearing in front of them. And in some circumstances across the state, the magistrate comes up for reappointment. The senator doesn't reappoint them, but the magistrate stays in office on holdover status. So effectively, on a day-to-day basis, that magistrate's job depends on the goodwill of that senator who is now practicing in front of him and representing his client who's paid him well to get him out of that DUI. Yeah.
Yeah, I need to make absolutely sure people understand what the solicitor just said. We have something called holdover status. So if you have been hired for a 4-year gig and your 4 years is up, it doesn't mean you leave. You can continue to stay. You don't have a new 4-year protection. You don't even have a 4-hour protection. You can be removed at the whim and caprice of the senators from that particular jurisdiction. And I cannot imagine a system that inspires less confidence than when a lawyer legislator can literally get rid of the judge that he or she appears in front of later that afternoon. How in the world is that fair for the victim, the cops, and the prosecutors?
Yeah, and the community that doesn't want drunk drivers on its roads. And this is a service, really. And I testified before the House Subcommittee on Judicial Selection last fall, and I told them, this is a marketable service. If you are a defense attorney and I tell you I hired the judge we're going to be appearing in front of. So, yes, that other lawyer may be charging $3,000 and that's less than I'm charging. But, you know, if you want the guy who hires the judge, you got to pay me $6,000. It is literally a marketable service that a senator can bank on because it is something that he can do that nobody else can do.
We'll be right back with more of the Trey Gowdy podcast. You know, I guess this is what confuses me is that I've always thought of South Carolina as being a red state, which traditionally means pro-law enforcement, pro-public safety. And it certainly sounds like there are better ways that we can pick our judges. Even in a ruby red state like ours, it seems to be, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think people would be shocked. You know, I mean, it took us 8 years to get some movement on getting chemicals to administer the death penalty. All we needed was a law that made the vendors anonymous and they would sell to us, but we couldn't get that passed. And I don't understand why. It is incredibly challenging to get pro public safety legislation moved. Sometimes we worked for 3 years to get a fentanyl trafficking bill, and it was only until a bunch of mothers and parents of kids who died from fentanyl overdose started showing up at the legislature and raising hell about it that the legislature finally got religion on this issue. Until then, we couldn't move the needle. Not only did they not want to pass a fentanyl trafficking statute, they were going to gut the mandatory minimum sentences on our existing trafficking statutes so that, you know, there was essentially no difference between distribution and trafficking. It was really just remarkable. And I wonder if the people really knew what was going on, I think they'd be appalled and they'd be outraged.
Yeah, well, they don't know. I mean, I think what they maybe perhaps know is of the 170 members of our General Assembly, I can think of two who used to do what you currently do. Two wonderful people, Greg Hembree and Tommy Pope.
Yep.
But I can't think of a single solitary current prosecutor among those 170. That would be dual office holding. So you're out of luck there. But there are scores and scores of the 170 who make a living on the other side of the courtroom doing criminal defense work in an allegedly ruby red Republican state.
Yeah, and they are able to put their thumbs on the scales. When it comes to drafting laws, we have one terrible DUI law. In South Carolina, it really is just so many advantages for the defendant baked into it. It was literally drafted by defense attorneys. Conservative cause is usually identified with law and order and pro public safety. But you've got some people up there that are very powerful. Our Senate Judiciary Chairman Luke Rankin, for example, who just is able to stymie our efforts to get pro public safety, and he's leading the charge to prevent judicial reform. It's sad because, you know, we work hard to try to keep the public safe. Law enforcement prosecutors, we really do. And we just need the tools to do it. And we need, you know, cooperation from the legislature. And there's some great people up there who really work hard, not just Tommy and Greg. They're staunch, reliable allies, but there's some other good ones up there too. But the people who seem to make a difference and have the most power don't seem to be friendly to us.
I must have been gone a long time because Luke Rankin was a Democrat back in the day, was he not?
Arguably still maybe. A good case could be made. I think I could prove that one beyond a reasonable doubt, Ray.
I tell you what. Well, people wonder in a state that, you know, claims to love law enforcement and wants to stand up for the victims of crime and is pro public safety. We got some areas. You mentioned our DUI statute. Our DUI statute is 1,000 times harder to prosecute than our murder statute. I'd rather do a murder case than do a DUI case.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they wrote into the original statute that you had to videotape the roadside field sobriety tests. And then they deemed that to mean that even if the defendant's feet were off the video because the camera wasn't tilted down enough, that resulted in the suppression of the tape and dismissal of the charge. And they finally just fixed that in some case law. But I mean, it's just been a battle with all the loopholes they've built in there. So, you know, recently, speaking of Luke Rankin, he was one of the people that complained and said, you know, too many cases are being plea bargained on, too many DUIs. It's like, well, you know what? The problem isn't us. The problem is the law you've given us. If you fix the law, we wouldn't have to negotiate so much. But when you make the law so Byzantine and complicated and bake in so many loopholes and problems that then we have to compromise because it's the only justice we can get out of it. Sometimes a reckless is the best we can do because of problems in the law, not necessarily the evidence. So, yeah, it is frustrating. It's very frustrating to be, you know, in law enforcement. It's frustrating to be a prosecutor in South Carolina.
Well, that is rich. That is rich to have someone complain about the DUI law, which is 16 pages long. Last time I checked, murder statute may be two sentences long.
Yeah.
Complaining about the inability of prosecutors to be able to prevail in cases that they intentionally made next to impossible to prosecute. Well, I want to end on a happy note. Tell us something about your job that we did not know, something that brings you, you mentioned the joy that you get from clearing someone who is factually innocent. Leave us with something positive for a young woman, a young man who's thinking about going into law enforcement, maybe aspires to go to law school, maybe wants to be the next Kevin Brackett, but is not sure because prosecutors are getting a lot of criticism in some cases. Give us a reason to do it.
You have more ability as a prosecutor to influence the safety in your community than you ever could on the other side of the courtroom, because my obligation is to the community. My obligation is to do the right thing, not, you know, and a defense attorney's obligation is to his client. Even if he thinks his client is guilty, if his client says he's not and he wants a trial, well, then you're duty bound to go into court and try to make that case to a jury of 12. I am not encumbered with any of these kinds of problems. I go in and I do the right thing. And there's a luxury to that. But not just that. I'm able to look and see what problems exist in the system and agitate to try to fix them. Judicial reform is one of them. Right now, the other big issue on my mind is fentanyl. Fentanyl is killing 5 South Carolinians every single day, and it's just going to get worse because they're starting to put this new stuff in there called xylazine, which makes it hard for Narcan to work. We're going to start seeing people die by the score if we don't reverse course. But because of changes they made in the law, making it harder to revoke people's probation, Trey, has become something of a joke. I mean, you could do a whole other episode just on that, because they don't want people's probation to be revoked. They don't want to send people to prison. So what does that mean for your average fentanyl addict? That means that when they get caught and charged with possession, they're put on probation, they could test dirty again and again, and they're not getting revoked. They're being left out on the street to die. So I'm trying to agitate for some common sense reforms that will force these people to go into a drug court situation where when they test dirty, a judge will have the power to immediately incarcerate them. Not for a long time, a week, 2 weeks. It just gets worse and worse over time, forcing them to embrace recovery. These are things I'm able to do as a prosecutor that you can't do on the other side of the courtroom. So if you're in law school and you're listening to this and you're wondering how to best deploy your brand new law degree and your membership in the South Carolina Bar, you really should consider being a prosecutor. You can do so much good for your community in that position, far more than you can do for any single individual. And defense attorneys are important. I'm not running them down. But if you really want to make a difference, this is the place to do it.
Most rewarding job I've ever had. People have heard me say that until they're sick of hearing me say that. But being a prosecutor is the most rewarding job, and the one that I hope people will remind my wife of when they come through the receiving line. That is the, if I make it to heaven, and I'm not sure I will, solicitor, but if I do, it will be based on my work as a solicitor. And one thing's for sure, neither one of us are going to be judges now, not after we have critiqued the way that the General Assembly elects judges, but that's okay. I can't sleep sitting in a chair anyway, so I don't aspire to that. Hopefully, solicitor, people, when they do bump into their lawyer legislators, and many of them are your friends and my friends, but my friends can be right and wrong. And the way that we pick judges, I don't think is fair to the judges, and I know it's not fair to the public. Hopefully, people who listen to this that live in South Carolina or whatever state they listen to will pay attention to how judges are selected, because there might very well be a better way. Thank you for doing the Lord's work, Solicitor Kevin Brackett.
Well, thank you for having me, Trey. I really enjoyed being with you this morning, and look forward to seeing you soon.
All right. And best of luck to you. I don't know when you're on the ballot again. I guess you have to face the voters too, don't you?
I do, every 4 years. That's right. I got to reapply for the job. I'm in the middle of it now.
Well, I cannot. I don't live in your circuit. It's none of my business what happens there beyond. You were always somebody that I relied upon well before you ever became the solicitor, back when you were working for Tommy Pope. We could tell back then that you knew what you were doing, and you were someone that all of us relied upon for your judgment, your discretion, and your wisdom. So best of luck to you and whatever races may be on the horizon for you.
Thank you so much. That's very kind. I appreciate you, Trey.
All right. Take care, solicitor.
Yes, sir. You too.
Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.